Are we going?
I don't know.
Okay.
Welcome back to the Dark Light Podcast.
I'm Jill.
And I'm Jen.
And today's episode is going to be on Charles Starkweather. Have you ever heard of him? I bet you haven't, because I had never heard of him before. I fucking read the book on him and studied him. Have you ever heard of him before?
No.
No. Well, I know that previously our stories have been kind of like, you know, it's like their whole life story and then bam, murder, and then bam,
back to the life story.
Yeah. And this one is going to be a little bit different. This one might be a little bit triggering. So I do want to give a little warning.
A lot of it. True.
The parts that are like super triggering, we have put in trigger warnings. We will just say trigger warning, so just be afraid of anything that can come up. I have not gone into detail about a lot of it, so it's not going to be like, I can't handle this, but where I felt necessary, I did put a little trigger warning. I hope you guys are okay with that. And do you have, oh my god, I almost forgot.
What?
The card. But I'm going to do the moonology one. Oh, shit. I'm going to do the work for your light. Okay, so we are going to do a quick tarot reading. Before, I can't even fucking. Okay, so I'm going to shuffle and then I will read the cards and then it'll be Jen's turn. And then we can get into the story.
Dun, 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 dun.
Okay, so which card do I want to choose?
What's our theme song?
When you follow the lights into the woods, be careful of the stalkers in the hoods.
You don't know when they're watching or whose spell they be casting.
Be careful for the demons in the dark light. I made that up myself. No big deal.
Just wanted to kill the silence.
All right, so trust your path. If you knew you would be supported, what would you do? And then I just read this. Okay, so let me just find it. I have the right symbol aligning your life, answering the call, boundaries, the crumbling.
So for me, like, that one felt like a question. Ow. To me, mm-hmm. It's like, what would you do if you were... knew you were supported or something?
Yeah.
I think I'd go to school.
You would go to school?
I'd go to school.
What would you take in school?
Something to do with animals, horses.
That's fair.
Because I always wanted to be a vet tech.
Yeah.
At a horse trainer. But I've been thinking of, it's pretty much short form, it's massage for horses.
Okay. I didn't know you would have to go to school for that.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know anything about that, so.
Yeah, and then, like, chiropractor work, and, like, there's so many cool things you can do with horses now. That wasn't really around when I was...
going to school.
And had horses.
Or, like, wanted to.
Before, yeah. Yeah, my horses have got... more massages this year alone than I ever have in my entire life.
That's fair.
For them.
All right, so trust your path. If you knew what you would be supported, what would you do? The universe is conspiring. Keep facing your true north. Your job is not to pave the path, but to simply keep facing your true north and take one step after another. If you do this, you can't go wrong. The universe is conspiring. Don't waver or doubt. Use your heart as a compass and put one foot in front of the other. If you follow the invisible trail of what lights you up, you will light up the world without even trying. Most people don't follow the highest call in their soul because they are waiting to see the end destination before they can take the first step. If you take one baby step each day within the year, you will have taken 365 steps in your dedicated direction. If you wanted to write a book, write a page every day. You want to change careers, do one thing in a day in dedication to that. Before you know it, in just a year from now, you will turn your back and look in awe at how far you have come, as to how far you have journeyed. Keep moving and open yourself to a whole new level of support and receiving. Things are not going to work out the way that you were planning, but if you have little faith and keep showing up, they will work out even better than you could possibly imagine. Don't micromanage the universe. Trust your path and let your soul lead the way. Work your light inquiry. If you knew you would be supported no matter what would you do? And you know what? That made me feel like the podcast. Like, because I've been wanting to start a podcast for so long.
Yeah.
And I'd been working towards it and everything. And I just never had the courage to step up. And then one day you messaged me and you were like, were you the one that wanted to start a podcast? And I was like, yeah, why? And you were like, I want to start one. And I was like, let's do it. Are you busy today?
Like, I couldn't even contain myself. Like, because I was driving home from work thinking about it.
Yeah.
I ended up doing the whole, like, speak text you. Because I was like, I can't wait until I get home to text you.
Yeah.
Oh, is it my turn?
It is your turn. You have to pull one. We both get to pull one. But I know when you messaged me and I was like, literally went into like hyperventilating mode. I was like, oh my God. Like, because I did not, it was something that I really wanted to do, but yeah. I did not want to do it alone. And I had nobody who wanted to start one with me.
Except for me.
Yeah, until you had actually said so. Like, because I had talked to you about it and you're like, oh, that's so cool. And I'm like, yeah.
How cool.
And then like, I don't know. I think it was like maybe a month after and you were like, were you the one? And I'm like, yeah, I was. And then I asked Adam and I was like, do you care if I start a... Or no, I didn't even say that. I was like, I think I was already here. We had already recorded and put our first piece out. And I was like, I'm starting a podcast with Jen. And he's like, good job, babe.
Like, I'm just so, like, I told everybody, I'm like, yeah, we're starting a podcast.
Yeah, and I'm just, like, the complete opposite, and I'm like, I'm not gonna tell anybody until we're, like, decently, like, we can get past our flaws a little bit, and did you find your card?
Yes.
What does it say?
Those are some.
It says, Council of Light, Divine Orchestration, Helpers in the Subtle Realms.
What was the...
It's a triangle. That was the same one as mine.
I think, are they not all triangles in this one?
Well, I don't know. Not my book. I will give the card back to you so that you can read to look through it.
I can't remember how to do this one.
Do you guys have any, like... If you guys have any, like, cool tarot card books that you want us to look into or start reading on the podcast, just, like, email the title of them or a picture of them. A picture of them would be even better to the darklightpodcast@hotmail.com. And so that way we can go and try and find some more. We are located in Canada, so it has to be a Canadian one. But, like, I just want to... Do you want me to take a peek? I just want to, like, get all of them. And I went to go buy one the other day, and then I just found a... Like, I went... Well, that's a lie. I went into Chapters to find a cup. And then I went to the books, and I was like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, I'm just going to go look for a tarot deck card. Like, a tarot deck. Thinking I was going to at least come out with one of those and then a cup. And I came out with two books, and a cup. And the cup wasn't even the one that I wanted, but surprisingly, Chapters didn't have the fucking cup that I wanted.
What cup were you even looking for?
I was looking for one that had a straw, and I did not have one that had a straw. It had, like, wine cups and cocktail cups. And then it had, like, water bottles. And then it had, like, the cozies, like what we have.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Council of Light is a team of... Benevolent... Why can't I read today? Holy fuck. You read it. I quit.
The Council of Light is a team of benevolent beings who are here to assist the raising of consciousness and the planet. They are here to help you achieve your soul mission and are guiding you every step of the way. However, we live in a world where free will reigns. They cannot help you without your permission. If you would like their assistance, it is time to ask them. They can be a big help with all kinds of requests. Nothing too big or too small. Think of them as your personal team of helpers in the spirit realm. They are willing and ready to step in and get to work. What would you like them to help with? What tasks would you like to delegate to them? The Council of Light is a team of ascended masters, light beings, angels, and guides devoted to the rising of Earth and humanity. If you are a light worker, it is from them that you receive the personal mission. Like a spirit, World United Nations, they want to thank you so much for doing this work and devoting your life to uplifting the planet. Pray for them for clarity and guidance regarding your personal mission. Put in your request and let them get to work. Work on your light activation. Oh my god! Hold the card in your heart and say, Council of Light, I am ready to receive help for fulfilling my personal Derek mission. Thank you for guiding me and clarity every step of the way and for sending me helpers and experiences that delight my mind, soul, and body.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Okay, should we get into this?
Yeah. Now? That one did not speak to me at all.
No, I think the other one was good.
All right, so like I said, we are going to be talking about Charles Starkweather, who was born on November 26, 1938 in Lincoln, Nebraska. He was the third children of eight, and there was seven boys and one girl. His father was Guy Starkweather. He was described as a joyful guy, but he liked to drink. He was a handyman. This is Guy that we're talking about. And he also couldn't always work due to arthritis. Jen is about to sneeze, so just burp. Pause for a minute.
His mother, Helen, was a waitress, but after 1946, she became the sole provider of her big family. For her big family. Charles had good memories for the first 6 years of his life. He liked to play with his older brothers, Rodney and Leonard. And he was always very helpful around the house. And he enjoyed fishing with his dad.
In 1944, Charles was made to give a speech at school, which led him to being bullied for his speech impediment. He had red hair and short legs, which also caused him to be bullied. On the second day of school, he got into a fight, and after that day, he would get into a fight almost every day.
He had a high IQ.
He was very, very smart.
He was, but was treated as a slow learner. At 15, he found out he needed glasses, which also would add on to the bullying.
Charles was described as short-tempered. He wore a second-hand clothes, not by his choice, but because his family grew up poor, that was all he could afford. Classmates gave him the nickname, quote, Little Red, unquote. He had a reputation of a fighter. Guys from all over the city would come and try and fight him due to this reputation.
This is when his rebel stage began. Bob von Brush?
I think it's Brush. Sure.
Fought him as one of the tough kids. They then became good friends. Charles dropped out of junior high in 1954 at the age of 16. He took a job in a newspaper warehouse. The boss treated him like he was slow.
His relationship with his father would fall through the cracks. Charles and his dad had this really big fight, and Charles went to go live with Bob and Bob's father. Bob and Charles would often get into a lot of, like, criminal stuff, so they would joyride in stolen cars, and then they would strip them from spare parts. They would also do a lot of other stuff, but I didn't write that stuff down. Bob did get a girlfriend, Barbara, which meant pretty much bye-bye, Charles. Though they did still remain friends. It was just like, you know, they didn't see his, yeah, they didn't see each other as much. In 1956, when the two went on a double date, and Charles' double date would be Bob's girlfriend's younger sister, Carol.
Carol was 13, but could easily have passed for 18. Carol's dad was a peeping Tom, and her mother was an alcoholic. Carol and Charles were perfect for each other. Both Carol. What did I say? Carl again?
Carl. It's because Carol. I fucking wrote it as Carl for so many times, and then it goes to Carol.
Yeah. Where was I? Carol and Charles were perfect for each other. Both were bad in school, considered slow, and little life experience. After the first date, Carol went out with another guy. Charles tracked him down and threatened to kill him if the two ever went out again.
Now I think I'm going to keep saying Carl. Charles and Carol began a steady relationship. He had quit his job at the warehouse and he went to go work full-time at the garbage trucks, which he had previously been working part-time for with his brother. Carol's mom and stepdad did not approve of the relationship. Charles' dad banned Carol from driving for whatever reason. But Carol was in a minor car accident, which caused Charles' dad to hit him so hard that he went through a window.
This caused Charles to move out of his house for good. He moved in with Bob and Barbara, who were now married, which he would soon move out of their house into an apartment on the same block.
I'm not exactly sure what Carol and Charles would talk about when they were alone, but it wasn't good as he finally felt, quote, he had something to kill for, and he wasn't speaking metaphorically. He now had one purpose in life, and that was for Carol to watch him go down shooting and know it was for her.
He said death had to come. Charles loved buying presents for Carol, but didn't have lots of money to do so. So he found another job as a cowboy. He loved it. It gave him access to guns. He would spend hours cleaning and oiling them. He loved to shoot. Despite having bad eyesight, he had really good aim. To keep Carol, he had to start planning his criminal career. He had to go big. Aha! Bank robbery, he thought. Well, maybe he should start smaller, like a gas station. That would be perfect.
Although he tried, it went terribly wrong. You see, he had everything planned out. When the time came to act, the new employee working, Robert Colbert, he was just 21 years old. He was fresh out of the Navy. He had just gotten married earlier that year, and he was expecting his firstborn child.
Sorry.
I was mocking Jen yawning. Sorry, guys. We need to be on video so, like, people can see what's going on. So you're just sitting there, like, trying to hide a yawn. And then I'm, like, mockingly, like,
Oh, God. When Charles showed up around... I can't stop laughing. When Charles showed up around 3 a.m. with the shotgun he stole from Bob's cousin, Sonny, Robert didn't know the passcode for the safe where all the money was kept. Charles forced him at gunpoint into his car and forced him to drive. They drove up a road to a little-known place called Lover's Lane.
Charles said, as the two got out of the car, so I do want to say that the main source that I got this from was a book that was written from the sight of Charles, so a lot of it is Charles' alleged what happened. So Charles said, as the two got out of the car, Robert reached for the gun. Amongst the fight, Charles claimed that Robert shot at himself first. The bullet didn't go through him. Nope. The bullet didn't kill him. He did try and stand by Charles, put the gun to Robert's head, and he pulled the trigger. The second shot killed him.
Charles was... nervous but full of glee. He hadn't felt this wonderful since being a child. From this killing, he stole $108. $108 is not worth a man's life, especially when 5 months later, Robert's widowed wife would give birth to a beautiful baby girl.
Carol was picked up by Charles later that day, and he told her all about the excitement that went on, though he claimed that somebody else had actually pulled the trigger, but he would not name who. Later that day, he threw the shotgun into the lake, but then he regretted it, so he went and he fished it out. He cleaned it up like he knew how to because of his cowboy job, and he put it back in Sunny's garage. Sunny had never known it was even gone.
During the police investigation, Charles' name came up lots, but for some reason, he was never spoken to. Charles spent his newfound money on things like new clothes, a paint job for his car, you know, because that stuff was
super, like, nonchalant.
Yeah. Like, not trying to cover anything up or anything.
No, but, like, my fucking $2,000 fucking new car paint, like, that money came out of nowhere.
Exactly. The manager of the gas station reported his suspicions, but like I said, nothing would ever come of this.
Charles felt like he would be able to do whatever he wanted without getting caught. This was only his first time, and he had succeeded. Oh, what a joy it was to be him. Or so he thought.
He lost his job since he never showed up anymore. He spent all the money quickly. Soon he began to get behind on rent. You know what this meant. He would have to strike again. January 19th, 1958, Carol and Charles had a huge fight. She told him she never wanted to see him again.
He let her go, be angry, but he didn't take her very seriously. He was supposed to go hunting with her family in the days coming up. He went to his brother Rodney's house while he let her calm down for a bit until he had to go meet up with her family.
Since he left his gun at the house, he had to use his brother's 22 bolt action rifle. January 21st, 1958, he set out on his journey to reconcile with his girlfriend Carol. And for some reason, he gave some rugs that he found from his garbage rounds to Carol's mother to reconcile.
I don't know. The book said that, and I'm like, what the fuck does that even mean? And I Googled and Googled and Googled, and I could not find anything. And I'm like, that is such a weird thing. Like, here is a fucking slab of rug. Do you forgive me?
From the garbage.
Yeah. No, even if it wasn't from the garbage, here is a slab of rug.
Exactly. Yeah, that's just random.
Yeah.
She was not pleased, obviously. While Charles sat in the living room cleaning his gun, Velda, Carol's mom, told Charles that Marion, Carol's dad, would not be going hunting with him and that he should leave and never come back.
She allegedly, according to Charles, got up and hit him in the face. This was Velda, of course. He ran from the house, forgetting the gun, so he had to run back to grab it where he was met with Marion, who was yelling at him. Charles did what any sane person would do, obviously, and he walked down to Marion's work to tell them that he would be sick for the next few days and not to expect him. Can you imagine if you found out that somebody came to your work and was like, hey, Jen's not going to be in town for a bit, so don't expect her at work.
Maybe this is because I watch and read and all these things about crime, I would instantly be like,
something's
wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if any...
Especially being the boyfriend of their daughter.
Yes. And, like, for me, like, I am somebody who barely misses work and literally has not missed a day of work pretty much up until this year when everything kind of started. I had COVID with Carson and everything going on. I had not missed a day of work. I had never called into sick work since the day that I started. I did have like a few weekends off, like dance recitals. I did take like a weekend off to go boating, not at this job, but like in the days that I worked. Yeah. But like, if somebody were to go to my boss and be like, yeah, she's gonna be sick.
Yeah.
He'd be like,
no.
Hopefully he would be like, no.
Yeah.
Like, that's just weird.
Right? Charles drove Marion's car to a friend's house, then walked back to the house. Velda had accused Carol of being pregnant, which caused a huge fight between the mother and daughter. She began to slap Charles in the face when he arrived. He then hit her back.
Marion came to back up his wife. Marion grabbed Charles by the throat and began to drag him out the door, but Charles kicked him and then proceeded to wrestle him to the ground. Marion, though, escaped and went to look for a weapon, but Charles did the same.
Marion had grabbed a claw hammer and started to charge at Charles, but Charles had his brother's gun locked and loaded. Bang! Marion had been shot in the head. Charles reloaded the gun and Carol grabbed it, threatening her mother. Velda knocked Carol down, which caused Charles to grab the gun and shoot her in the head as well. He then hit her in the back of the head with the gun and shot her two more times.
Trigger warning, Carol's 2.5-year-old sister, Betty Jean, was crying. Charles hit her in the head with the rifle, which made her cries even louder. Charles picked up the kitchen knife. Charles allegedly picked up the kitchen knife, threw it at her, and hit her in the neck, which killed her. And I say allegedly because this is what I have read. But how often do you just whoop?
Yeah,
and like that's like right in the neck. Yeah. So I don't know.
Marion was still alive, so Charles went and killed him, as per Carol's request. Then he sat down with his gun and watched TV.
The two wrapped her family's bodies in rugs and sheet and then carried them out into the yard. They placed Velda's body into a toilet outside. Betty Jean's body was placed in a box on top of the toilet, and Marion's body was hidden in an abandoned chicken coop they had on the yard.
They then proceeded to tidy up the house as best as they could, then proceeded to watch more TV. Carol would later claim she was not there for the slaughtering of her family, and she walked into Charles sitting on the couch with a gun and her family gone.
So as you'll find out, like, a lot of it, like 98% of it, was Charles versus Carol during the trials. So Carol, I don't want to say played, but was the victim in all of this. Mm-hmm. And Charles was the manipulator. But Charles would claim that Carol had everything to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. She claimed that he had told her that her family... She claimed he told her her family found out about a bank robbery and the rest of his crew had them and was being held hostage. If she didn't cooperate, they would die. Carol claimed that when Charles would leave her alone in the house, she had to be tied up so that she could not escape.
Charles would deny this. The couple wed and got a dog named Nig and a puppy named Kim. They hung a sign in the kitchen window in the parents' house which said, "Stay away, everybody is sick with the flu."
Anybody who knocked on the door, Carol would tell them that the family was in quarantine while Charles hid in the bedroom with his gun cocked. Barbara, Bob, and their new baby came to visit the family as Barbara was worried since she hadn't heard from her mom in a few days. Carol yelled at her to back off, and obviously this would scare Barbara because she had her newborn baby and she felt like something was off. She would turn around and she would send Bob and Rodney back to the house.
Barbara reported the incident to the police, who went to check at the house. Carol told the police that everyone had the flu and that the reason they were called was because the family didn't get along with Bob,
which was obviously a lie. The police left. When Rodney got his gun back, he noticed damage on the butt end of his rifle. Lavetta, who was Charles's sister, arrived at the house. She had none of the flu story and she was determined to find out what was going on. Dun dun dun.
Carol told her that Charles was planning a bank robbery and had to leave. Lavetta went back and told her dad. Velda's mom, Pansy, was worried and showed up at the house. She did not believe the flu story either. So Carol said that Velda was in danger. The police were called by many people, so they decided to send a cruiser up. When they were on their way to the, house the next day, since so many people had shown up. The couple had ran, as they figured they had been sought out.
They drove off to a man who was family friends with Charles's family nearby an abandoned schoolhouse. They had slept at the schoolhouse to rest, and then when they got up, they went to August's house. August was a friend's family.
The friend's family.
Yes.
When they got there, he shot him and the dog. They rampaged their house and got some money and clothes. In the process of leaving the house, they got their vehicle stuck. They tried to dig it out, but a nice neighbor who didn't know what was going on stopped to help them. They got out with his assistance and wanted to go towards the schoolhouse, but then changed their minds and turned around.
On their way, they ran into 17-year-old Robert Jensen, who had offered the couple a lift. Robert was also joined by his 16-year-old fiancée, Carol King. For the rest of the story, I will be calling her King, not to confuse the two Carols. Charles told the young lovers that the gun wasn't loaded, though that would not be true.
Even though the couple were nice enough to give them a lift, Charles declared that he did not like them. They were the prom king and queen style kids, the ones that used to bully him. Charles put the gun to the back of Robert's head and made him give up his wallet.
He decided that they would use this chance to go back to Lincoln, forcing Robert to drive where he said. He would then change his mind and make them turn back around. They turned back to the school. Charles would then force the lovers out of the car at gunpoint. He shot Robert four times, negative. He shot Robert six times in the ear. When King's body was originally found, she was originally found with a single bullet in the back of her head.
She was partially nude, laying on top of Robert. Her back was scratched and muddy. She had also been stabbed several times in the groin. The autopsy would show signs of internal damage to her cervix, vagina, and rectum. The damage was caused by a rigid double-edged blade that did not match Charles' hunting knife.
She had not been sexually assaulted, though Charles claimed he thought of doing it. Charles would accuse Carol of going into a jealous rage and stabbing King. This was allegedly because he had pulled her pants off and was thought about raping her, and then Carol was like, what the fuck, basically, and stabbed her. They then returned to Robert's car and stole it. They drove back into Lincoln to see if the family had been discovered, which they had been, so they left.
They had planned to drive out of state, but Charles decided they should hit up the rich part of town with the mansions and the nice cars. They pulled over to take a nap before they found their next victim. They decided on a mansion.
One belonging to millionaire industrial Seward. Seward was a 47-year-old. He was president of Capital Bridge Company and Capital Steel Company. Lucky for him, he went to work that morning. It was unlucky for Lillian Fensel, who was a 51-year-old maid. She had worked for the Wards for years.
Charles was used to this side of town because it was where he worked before he got fired from the garbage truck company. Because of this, Lillian may have recognized him. When Lillian answered the door, Carol and Charles flaunted their guns and forced themselves into the house.
The only other person who was home was Clara Ward. She was very active in the community. As long as the two agreed to cooperate, he said he would not harm them. After a few hours of being at the home, after 1 p.m., Charles allegedly went to let Mrs. Ward change. When he went to go check on her, she had a gun and she shot at him. When she missed, she had turned around to run away, but Charles still threw his hunting knife at her, lodging it straight into her back. She was still alive. He dragged her into the bedroom and threw her on the bed.
With all this commotion going on, the family dog was going crazy. Charles would hit the dog with the butt end of the rifle, causing his neck to break. He bound and gagged Miss Ward and covered her with bed sheets to keep her from trying to call anyone.
Meanwhile, the police had come upon August's home and found the bodies of August, King, and Robert. Lots of police combed their residence and started looking for the runaway couple. Charles called his father and told him that he was going to kill Bob for coming between Carol and him.
He also wrote a letter reading "The Law Only" on the front cover, saying that after Bob and his wife were killed, they would commit suicide. This would cause Bob and the family to keep from coming to the house.
Around 6 p.m., Mr. Ward arrived and stared at Charles, who had a rifle, which obviously caused a fight. The gun fell into the basement. When going after it, Charles got the gun first and shot at Mr. Ward, which hit him in the back while he was running up the stairs. Despite this, he kept running. He made it all the way to the front door, but Charles caught up to him and he shot him in the side of the head. Though police would claim that Charles would shoot Mr. Ward as soon as he walked into the house.
The maid was still unharmed. Charles took her upstairs, tied her up, and stole her money. Carol watched her. Before they would leave, they would find her dead. Charles tried to dye his hair black with shoe polish. They also stole food and left.
The Wards would be found by a relative who showed up at the house the next day. This relative went to check in on Mr. Ward since he had not shown up to work, which was not like him. When authorities did the autopsy, it was shown that it was the same knife that had killed King.
Charles would claim that the women were left alive when they had left the home. Carol later claimed that Charles admitted to her that he stabbed the maid, Lillian Fensel. The news in town would be littered with their pictures.
$1,000 was up for their capture of Charles. National Guard was called. The city was sealed off on each block.
Air flights were looking for a blue placard truck Charles stole from August. Though the search was going on, the two were gone, nowhere in sight. They were now in Wyoming and tired.
They stopped for gas in Douglas. In Douglas, they would meet Merrill Callison, a 37-year-old who sold shoes. He was married with two children. He had been on his way home from a work trip. He had been sleeping and woke to Charles telling him that they were going to switch vehicles. Basically, he woke up to Charles fucking banging on his windshield, being like, yeah, we're going to switch vehicles. But Marl tried to sleep through it. When Charles pulled the gun, Marl agreed. When he opened the door, Charles shot him 7 times in the face, chest, arm, and leg, and then he took his car. But he didn't just leave Marl. He shoved Marl in the front passenger seat of Marl's own vehicle.
Another man, 29-year-old geologist Joe Sprinkle, saw Merle slouched over in the front seat and stopped to see if he was okay. Joe realized what was happening when he saw Merle close up and tried to grab the gun. At this point, Wyoming Sheriff Deputy William Romer saw what was going on. He pulled over. Carol got out of the car, ran to William, and said, "Take me to the police." Charles drove off. William called for backup. They went on a police chase.
The police shot into his back window. Charles thought he had been shot since there was blood coming from his neck, but in fact this was just a piece of glass that had hit him. Finally, Charles gave up. He stopped the car and walked towards the police vehicle.
The two were taken in. Carol tried to claim she was Charles' captive. Charles wrote a note to his parents basically saying Carol had nothing to do with the murders, just wanted to get out of town.
Carol's story would change lots. Can I get a little drink? Yeah. Carol's story would change lots. Charles admitted to all murders except Clara Warren and Lillian Fensel. He admitted that they were alive when he left. Charles was expedited to Nebraska. Allegedly, he would be, quote, afraid of flying, unquote, but this was because he would have a better escape if he were to go through the car.
Carol and Charles were both charged with first-degree murder. This would make Carol the youngest woman tried in U.S. history. Both plead not guilty, both were guilty, and both tried guilty. He could have been charged as insane, but nobody remembers a crazy man.
Though he had many psychologists, sorry, Jen, because you can never pronounce a word. I think while I was writing the story, I was really fucking hoping that you would get that word, and then I'd be like, sorry, Jen.
It's funny because I know the word, but whenever we do the podcast, my brain is just like, bah.
Yeah, just farts, yeah. Charles would agree. Charles would not agree to their sick pleas. He was recommended to the electric chair. The TV court appearance made him a celebrity. Since Carol took Robert's wallet, she would be an accomplice. Me and Jen are point talking.
He would claim in court that he no longer loved Carol and didn't care if she lived or died. Allegedly, he would even say, if I fry in an electric chair, then Carol should be sitting on my lap.
Carol's attorney believed that she was innocent. She was found guilty, and she was still sentenced to prison in life. She became a model prisoner. What?
You said prison in life.
She would be sentenced to life in prison.
Charles would write to Melvin Reinhardt, a professor of criminology, right?
Criminology,
yeah. Explaining that he was just getting revenge on the human race. He wanted them to believe that he killed those who killed him slowly, but he killed them in a hurry so they didn't have to suffer. Basically, he put the blame on whatever he could other than himself. His execution was set for May 22nd, 1959.
And with that, that is the story of Charles Starkweather. And I fucking hope we never have another one of him. I don't understand how he was like, let me kill one person. Oh my God, let me go killing your entire family.
Yeah, I don't... I don't know. There has to be more to that story. Like, either she was fucking... Like, she had to have been in on it, or she actually was...
Right, and it's one or the other.
Yeah.
There's no in between. What do you think? Do you think she was a victim, or do you think that she was involved in it?
I mean, I think she was involved in it, because if somebody did that to my family, I would fucking die trying to save them.
Yeah.
I'd go down...
Yeah.
In a fucking heartbeat trying to save my family.
Yeah. I do agree with that. I also feel like she was involved. If she wasn't, very sorry. But from what I have read, I do believe that she
was
involved.
I mean, it is hard to say, like, if it was abuse and stuff like that, then, like, a lot of people do handle it differently.
Yeah.
Me, I'm just too fucking stubborn. But if somebody's trying to kill my family, I would be,
No.
Completely.
Yeah. I'd go 100% savage. Agree. Okay, well, on that note, you guys should go and check out our Hello, It's Joe and Jen Back at It Again podcast, where we just talk about random ass shit. And this week's, it's going to be Would You Rather questions. I have a list of questions that we are both going to read and answer.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And the rest of the podcast is, it's literally going to be each podcast episode is just going to be on a random topic. So, like I said, this one is going to be Would You Rather questions. One could be fucking, I don't know, sex topics or like...
Beef jerky.
Yeah, like literally anything. So just like keep an eye out. I do hope to make one about deep sea creatures, because you know how I am obsessed with them and how weird they are and why I'm scared of the ocean.
I'm fucking terrified of the ocean too.
Have you seen some of the fucking creatures down there? Yeah, fucking creepy.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm not even talking about like from Finding Nemo when there's that with the light in front of him.
No, there's worse things out there.
No, and that thing, let me tell you, is fucking creepy, but there's other really creepy ass things down there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And just knowing that below your feet, there's just so many miles of...
And there's sand sharks. I know. I fucking hate water, but I love swimming, and it's such a catastrophe in my mind.
It is so hard.
Right?
Like, I'm the same way, because I love swimming, too, but... And this is just, like, the fucked up part of me. So, especially when I swim in, like the Kamloops rivers or anything like that, I'm always, like, swimming along, and then I'm like, holy crap, what if, like...
There's a dead person?
Yeah!
That's me, too!
Because I can't see, and, like, what if you're, like, going underwater, and then all of a sudden, a hand.
Well, or, like, what if I'm, like, not even, like, if something popped up that would be absolutely fucking terrifying, but even just the thought of it, like, somebody could have been dumped here.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody could be living underneath me right now. It's fucked up, man.
Thank you. I know. When I talk to people, they're like, I just love swimming. And I'm like, how do you not think of that, though? Like,
I don't
especially
know.
In, like, the river, it's just, like, there could be, like, a body.
But I think people that aren't like us don't think about that.
That's but like then
people who are like us, who just, like, watch and listen to this all the time, think about it.
Oh, yeah. Like, that. Oh, my God. Like, I'm... Happy
okay, so one maybe episode will be about why me and Jen are scared of swimming in lakes. That could definitely be a great episode, and we could go on and on and on.
I think I'd have to say that water is one of my biggest fears.
Yeah.
And then water and heights, they're like...
I have...
And then snakes.
I have a lot of really big... fears, and I can't figure out which one comes first.
Those would be my three, like, water, heights, and snakes are up there.
See, mine is just insects. I fucking hate insects. If one comes near me, it's, no. I don't care if it's an ant, if it's a spider, if it is a fucking earwig, if it is, like, a worm. I don't know if a worm is an insect, but in this...
I don't mind, like, not, spiders, earwigs, yeah, don't touch me.
No.
But other things I'm not, like,
I literally freak out if there's a butterfly near me. The only exception is if it's a white butterfly, because my mom has detailed in my mind that a white butterfly is Carson, so I have to, like... physically calm myself down. Huh. And dragonflies used to freak me out, but my mom is like, it's just Georgie. And so whenever one comes near me, I'm like, it's Georgie, don't freak out. And I'm just like shaking and panicking.
But I am actually terrified. Like, I love dragonflies. They're those little mini helicopters are so cute.
Mini helicopters, that's so cool.
But they also terrify me.
Yeah.
But I think they're really pretty.
They are very beautiful, and they literally do no harm. But it's an insect, and I lose my mind. And the red ones are even fucking creepier.
We should do another podcast on dragonflies.
Okay, like, one episode might just be dragonflies. Okay, but this is like this the one. Type of fucking podcast that... Hey guys, welcome back again. What's the podcast name?
I thought it was Joe and Jen. Back at it again.
No, it's Hello, it's Joe and Jen. I think it's Hello, it's Joe and Jen. Back at it again.
I think that was just the episode.
Oh, fuck me. Okay, well,
we'll link it somewhere.
Yeah, we'll link it down below.
But thanks for listening to the Dark Leg podcast.
We hope to see you next week.
I was really hoping you were going to say, we wish you a Merry Christmas.
No, that's next week's episode. Next week's episode is going to be a Christmas episode.
I'm so wearing my Christmas sweater.
Bam. I will also wear a Christmas sweater. Sorry, guys, I'm dancing. All right, you guys can email us at thedarklightpodcast@hotmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at dark.klight.podcast_.
And you can follow us on Twitter at darklightpod1.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. We'll see you
next week.
And remember to keep
your lights on.